This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sherman Show. I'm Jeff Sherman. Without my co-host, Sam Lau, today, he is out moonlighting with Jeff Mayberry, so I'm having the Sherman Show without him. Today's Sherman Show guests are none other than DoubleLine's own Bill Campbell, Portfolio Manager for International Fixed Income, and Valerie Ho, Portfolio Manager, International Fixed Income. And today's episode, we're going to focus on geopolitical risk and what's going on in the global economy. So, international fixed income, first thing that comes to mind is geopolitical risk. That's what we really want to talk about today. It's on everyone's mind. Bill, why don't you kick this off? Russia, Ukraine, what's going on? What is it? How does it temper your outlook? What do you think about the conflict that's going on? And what does it mean, more importantly, for investors?
Absolutely. So obviously, Russia-Ukraine is top of mind for everyone. And I think it's worth first taking a step back and looking at how we got here to think about where we're going to go going forward. When we look at Russia's interests, they have been concerned about the expansion of the EU and NATO on their border for a long time. And there were a lot of efforts to try to appease this concern. But recently what we've seen is, Western economies, especially in Western countries, especially the U.S., have been supplying Ukrainians, with defensive weapons and, have failed to give Putin guarantees that Ukraine would never, or, at least in the, foreseeable horizon, become a member of either NATO or the EU. And I think when you look at the amount of cooperation and integration that's already happened, with Ukraine and the West, with receiving, an IMF agreement, with, also receiving the military, equipment, if you look out 5 to 10 years from Putin's perspective, it looked highly likely that, the trajectory of Ukraine was more West than neutral or East. And I think what happened here is we've seen an escalating crisis. We started to, see, the ratcheting up of tensions, on the eastern border. They have never really been resolved in Donetsk and Luhansk. But the tension started ratcheting up. We started seeing more weapons, introduced into the theater. Putin then decided to engage in military exercises on Ukrainian's northern border with Belarus. And I think the calculus eventually got to, for Putin, that, now is as good a time as any if he's going to try to stop this trajectory of Ukraine, fully moving into the Western orbit.
So is that more of a democratization of the Ukrainian people versus, kind of the Soviet rule, let's say, from Russia? Or what do you mean by all of that?
What I mean is, when you, when you become a member of NATO, that's a military alliance. And, that is an existential threat, I believe, to Russia, when you start to put that type of, threat directly on their border. They want at least a buffer zone, between the other NATO members. They want to have that buffer zone on their border. There is a long history of, Russia and Ukraine. And, I think Ukraine moving more towards, the people say democracy, but more towards the EU and out of the Russian orbit, is something that Putin did not want to happen on his watch. I think that, it's the, he gave an hour-long speech talking about, the historical ties of, Ukraine with Russia. And I think that it's, that type of, nationalist, and historical tradition that is also underlying, some of the motivation. But I think the true motivation is the existential threat of having, NATO actually on his, directly on his border. So last night he moved in. And his stated goal right now is to, remove the current government. Now, I think there is the focus that, yes, this is a democracy and he's removing a democratically elected government. But the way he's seen it is, the way that this government has been, all of their actions, really have been to try to, push Russia, farther, to kind of move a little bit more towards, Europe and, that NATO alliance and move Russia's influence out. And we saw that the conflict in eastern Ukraine, where there are a lot of Russian speakers, you have, a lot of Russian interests, the conflict has, been a hot conflict and it's been, carrying on, for the past 8 years. So, what started as, initially trying to fortify that border, I think just became, a decision by Putin that, now is as good a time as any. There is an appetite by the West to, have a full-scale ground military conflict in Ukraine. So he's going to try to, remove this current government, insert a government that is going to be, more pro, pro-Russian, that is not going to be taking Ukraine, in the European direction. And I think ultimately we're going to see initially a split. There's going to be the Western, countries are going to recognize Zelensky and his government. I'm not sure if he can, remain in Kiev or Kyiv, which, by the way, that's an interesting thing. I don't know if you've noticed on the news, the pronunciation and the spelling of Kiev has now changed to Kyiv, K-Y-I-V. And the reason is Kiev is the Russian pronunciation and Kyiv is the Ukrainian. So
is this a possible annexation of this part of Ukraine to become part of Russia? Or is it really just kind of striking an alliance?
I think that it's
complicated.
It's complicated. The annexation I thought would have been for eastern cities of Donetsk and Luhansk, and I thought that the peacekeeping forces would initially go in and try to take those as buffer zones. This is a complete expansion. You're having troops come in from the south out of Crimea. They're taking over the southern ports of Donetsk and Mariupol. You're having expansion from the east, and then you're also having troops, coming in from the north, from Belarus. This is a full-scale, invasion of the country, where I think they're looking to, replace the government in Ukraine to what it was before the Maidan, incident. So remember, Ukraine's prior to, the current governments, all of the Ukrainian governments, were sympathetic to Russia. And, there's been a long history of, Russia, having Ukraine in their sphere of influence. And it's only recently, that it's happened that Ukraine has moved out. So, I think from a legacy standpoint, too, Putin did not want to, lose Ukraine in the Russian sphere of influence and, didn't want to, bring NATO closer to his border. And I think when, you look, it was an opportunistic play, I think, by Putin. I think it caught most of the world, most of the markets by surprise how quickly he moved and this move last night, how aggressive it was. I think caught most people by surprise. But if you take a step back and, we're here in California in the United States and we consume a lot of, the Western press coverage of this. But when you kind of take a step back and look, at the Russian perspective, you can begin to see a little bit more why it happened. And I think that, now that he's in there, he's not going to, back out with anything less than reestablishing, a government that gives him guarantees of, having that sphere of influence in Ukraine.
So on that note, too, you talked about the Western world not really having an appetite for a ground war. And, there's really not this big appetite there. So instead, we're trying the economic sanction approach. And, you know, we're obviously in live markets right now as we go through this. But, you know, the markets seem to take the sanctions okay, but then the invasion, as we'll call it, last night, markets didn't like. But as the day goes on, it seems that, you know, it's kind of equilibrating. What is the long run on the sanctions? Is there another round coming? We've seen the first tranche, as it was called, from at least the U.S. government. We've seen the U.K. try to impose a little bit as well. What are your take on the sanctions, and what does this do for your outlook kind of on the global economy?
Yeah, no, great questions. So I think leading up to Joe Biden's speech today, there was obviously the market was expecting the worst case scenario, that prior to, you know, the invasion, we had already seen sanctioning of Russian government debt, but it was, to all new debt post March 1st of this year. The concern was that we would move to a Venezuela-style sanctions where, you know, no Western entity or individual would be allowed to hold any Russian debt. And since, you do have a large, foreign holdings of Russian government bonds, that would have caused, a real disruption, because you'd have to figure out where, how we would, get that debt into, you know, people's hands could actually hold it. Secondly, the SWIFT payment system for, international settlements of, trade, the Boris Johnson came out this morning and was advocating to, remove Russia from that SWIFT international payment system.
Which is a huge implication.
So that would have cut off, a lot of the energy trade that we're seeing between, Russia's ability to, settle not only energy, but they're involved in, a lot of technology, agriculture, fertilizer, metals. So all of that trade, would then, come to an immediate halt until we could figure out, another clearing system. Now, there are others.
That's where our crypto friends would say Bitcoin solves this.
Potentially, solves this, right? Potentially. Exactly. So, yeah, that's, you could get, we could have a blockchain solution for it, which, by the way, might be where we're going, in the second phase of this. But I think getting back to what was actually done, I look at what, Biden's, sanctions today, although he didn't go as far as removing Russia from SWIFT, he did say he was basically taken the large Russian banks, frozen their assets, and said that, they're not allowed to clear in U.S. dollars. And that is, a U.S. dollar trade still accounts for about 50% of Russian trade.
Oh, okay.
So I think that, the market was so focused on the SWIFT tagline that, the potential disruption that's happened, with the, sanctions implemented today, may take a few more days to play out. And, that's something to kind of keep, on our radar. And then finally, I think the market was relieved that there weren't direct sanctions on, Russian corporations, especially in the energy sector, that, that was expected as well. And that would have been massively, disruptive. So I think ultimately, though, where are we going with all of this? Like all of those items, like all of these sanctions, this, conflict is leading to higher energy prices due to lack of supply. And it's not only, and it's not just energy, other commodities as well. Agriculture, you have fertilizer issues, you have metals issues. You're going to see commodity prices remain at higher prices going forward. That's going to continue to keep inflation high globally. Like we are continually, at least, I know in our investment discussions and probably all investment discussions, across the globe, people are trying to figure out when those base effects are going to hit and when we're going to start to see inflation come down, and then when central banks can back off their tightening cycles, and we can start to get more enthusiastic about putting more credit trades on and pro risk trades on.
It's this amazing is that delaying you talk about that. This too, as we've been talking, setting the market up for the hiking cycle. We're going to battle inflation. Here, all of a sudden, you get this massive curveball, right?
100%. But this is so. This is where it's going to be very interesting to see how central banks actually across the globe manage it. Because on one side, you have the inflation shock, which needs to keep central banks on a tighter policy. On the other side, you're having a growth shock. And that would argue, and you know, a financial conditions shock. So you have tightening financial conditions due to this as well. So that would argue for, you know, central banks to back off. And it's going to be very interesting to see in these coming months and quarters, you know, one, how long does this geopolitical shock, you know, stay in the global system? How long does it, you know, keep inflation high? And, you know, how much of a knock on GDP is it? And what do central banks do? And if central banks remain relatively tight, that's going to be a very difficult environment for risk assets. The final, you know, piece that I do want to maybe circle back around to later would be, I think that ultimately what we're seeing here is the start of a new Cold War. You know, at the beginning of the Olympics, we saw Putin go over to Beijing. And before, you know, the Olympics really got underway, China and Russia signed a new 30-year energy deal where Russia's increasing oil, natural gas. They're also looking at putting in a second, another Siberian pipeline to, you know, supply more energy to China. And when you look at, you know, what the sanctions are effectively doing, they're pushing Russia more into the Chinese orbit, whereas, you know, there had been natural conflicts between those two that, you know, had prevented them from coming together. This morning, China did not condemn the movement of Russia into Ukraine. In fact, they criticized the U.S. for sending weapons. They said that, you know, they're trying to be the, you know, world's diplomat now and say, all sides should, you know, calm down. But ultimately, they're creating a new sphere of influence in the global economy. And going forward, I believe that, you know, with new Russian settlement systems, you have the Chinese digital currency, which is, you know, the blockchain solution that we talked about, and potential, you know, new settlement for, you know, commodities. It'll be very interesting to see, you know, as you have the Western kind of markets in orbit, and then the China-Russia markets in orbit that are, you know, now under development and are going to go into hyperspeed in development. It's going to be very interesting to see where, you know, emerging market countries align themselves more closely. And I think that, you know, that is actually where we're doing some thinking, you know, especially in the Latin America region, you know, as to, you know, how that, given that this geopolitical trajectory of a potential new Cold War, potential, you know, two new, you know, axes of economic power, you know, how countries will, you know, decide where they, you know, and how they're going to navigate that, and, you know, who they'll align more closely to, or how they'll try to manage between the two powers or between the two axes.
Yeah, so I think that's a good segue into Latin America. And Val, you're a resident expert on LATAM, everything LATAM here at Double Line. And so as I think about what's transpired there, there's been a lot of volatility in the elections. I feel like elections globally are extremely polarized. So what's going on in the Latin American region? Because everybody's dominated by this Ukraine and Russia situation. But there's a lot of noise going down south of the border from us, right? So talk to me about Latin America. What's going on in the election cycle? And, you know, what do you see as emanating risk from that side of the equation?
Yeah, absolutely. Just bringing it full circle with asset class performance, I thought what was really interesting was when all these geopolitical tensions were beginning to simmer, not counting today with the invasion, but I thought it was amazing watching EMFX performance. It held in just incredibly well despite all this really high tensions. And in particular, LATAM was performing very, very well, you know, and particularly Brazil, which was one of the best performing currencies, you know, within the GBI EM, the local currency index. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. One, you had, you know, a central bank that started a hiking cycle pretty early. It has very high real rates. But also you were seeing a rotation from Russian assets into Brazil, and it was considered somewhat relatively insulated from the crisis. Now we'll have to see given, you know, where oil prices go and what that does with inflation. But, you know, I thought it was relatively interesting that, you know, the strong performance there. That being said, we have a lot of risks on the horizon, and you nailed it. It's going to be the elections. They've been incredibly polarizing. Elections in Brazil will be in October. They're going to renew their lower house, a third of the Senate, hundreds of municipal and governorship elections. But the focus is certainly going to be on the president election. And this election cycle officially kicks off in August, but for me, it started actually last year in the spring, when former President Lula got his conviction overturned. He was charged with bribery for related to the Odebrecht scandal, if you remember that, back in 2015.
There's a movie about it on Netflix, by the way, very subtle. It shows up in it, too. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, I haven't seen that one. It's on my list, but
it's a pretty good movie,
I've been busy at home. Yeah. So so that really it paved the way for Lula to make a third run for the presidency. And, you know, I think the market expectation is that it's going to be a head-to-head against former President Lula and now President Jair Bolsonaro, who have very polar opposite positions. Now, if you believe the polls for Brazil, and I think it's still pretty early, and we can have a conversation of how credible polls are actually in Latin America, because sometimes it feels like the only thing predictable about polls is that they're unpredictable. But if you believe the polls, it looks like Lula is assuring for the next presidency. He has, you know, a 15-point lead in front of Bolsonaro. It's probably going to tighten as we get closer to the election. And, you know, a 30-plus point lead ahead of, you know, a third-party candidate. And I think the pathway for a third-party candidate is pretty narrow at this point. I think Bolsonaro would really have to stumble pretty hard or have some severe economic crisis, which, you know, possibly could happen in order to make way for a third-party candidate. So if, you know, you believe the polls, I think Lula is going to be the next president. I've, you know, one investor I was talking to said, you know, this is the most obvious election in Brazil history, Lula's assurance. So let's go with that base case there. What does that mean? Well, Lula's going to campaign on expanding the social benefit. He's going to campaign on a bigger role of the state, of more directed credit. And this is an issue because, you know, Brazil isn't Brazil of 2002 when he was president and when he got the boom from the commodity cycle. This is a very different economic situation where, you know, growth is anemic. You have very high debt levels approaching 90%. You have, you know, double-digit inflation. You have, you know, high real rates. And you have a big fiscal issue and a big fiscal credibility issue. So the big question, I think, for markets is going to be, can Lula be a pragmatic Lula in this situation? And I think, you know, I think Lula is going to be guided by how far he's going to guide his policies by how far he can push without making a crisis of confidence. And I think the market kind of says, okay, we're all right with that right now.
Sounds better than the other crises.
It sounds better than the other crises that are happening in the world. And I think that's part of the reason that, you know, the BRL, which is historically cheap, has been performing so well. But I do think fiscal risks are going to be on their horizon. I mean, Bolsonaro is not going to go down without a fight. Certainly not. You know, I think there's going to be a big push. He's embattled for more fiscal transfers. Right now, there is a big discussion right now about fuel taxes. You know, people are angry about fuel prices. They want to reduce that. We'll see where it goes. But probably you get more fiscal transfers. So I think the fiscal risk is going to continue to remain heightened. So, you know, something that we're certainly going to watch. It's going to be noisy. You know, I think the market's really bracing for a Lula third term.
Yeah. Well, if you want to complain about fuel prices, just go to your local Los Angeles gas station and try to fill up today.
You know, I never drive, so I honestly don't know how much it costs.
It's got a five handle on it, Valerie.
Okay. So over five and a half.
Yeah. It's getting close to five and a half. That said, you mentioned something that I've been kind of close to, was talking about the social aspect too, right? With the potential third term with Lula. Let's move to Chile, right? Because there was really some pivotal election that transpired there. And all of a sudden there was this change in this kind of social atmosphere too. They want to raid the pension systems. They want to change the dynamic. What are you thinking in terms of the risk in Chile? And what does that look like to you today?
Well, Chile is known as sort of the macro darling of Latin America. And, you know, social tensions have been simmering for a long time. If you remember in the fall of 2019, there were massive social protests all over Latin America. And this really...
Wasn't it the bus strike or something? The metro? Like they raised the metro price. Like
it was either... It's over something that, you know...
Seems trivial.
Trivial, but explodes into something much greater, showing the social inequities and the greater social pressure for goods and, you know, the need for more environmental protections. And then you have the pandemic, right? And that just highlights all of these social divides and inequities and lack of services that are really, really needed. Chile had elections, and Gabriel Boric is the next president-elect, but I think he's not the person to actually focus on right now. I think what we really need to be focused on in Chile is the constitutional convention that's going on right now. So out of the protests, it spurred the government to put to a referendum. Chileans voted overwhelmingly that they wanted to rewrite the constitution. So they elected a constituent assembly. We're about halfway through the process, a little bit over halfway through the process. It's a 12-month process with a hard stop deadline. And we have to see what's going to come out of this constitution. And
what are they trying to rewrite?
Well, that's a great question. It's a full rewrite. So it's goodbye Pinochet, yeah. Goodbye old constitution, yep. Hello new one. And I think that's, no one really knows yet. So just to get into the nuances really quickly, there's about 1,000 proposals that have passed this initial committee stage, and that just needs to pass with a simple majority. But then you need 2/3 of the full assembly to actually approve the measure and to make it into the constitution. And then there's a whole harmonization period. And what's coming out right now is it seems like the left is doing pretty well of coalescing that vote together and be able to push through stuff. But there's a lot of concerning articles that are coming out of this, out of the committees, things like nationalization of the mines, which would be absolutely huge. And devastating in terms of investment. They're talking about, reestablishing water rights. We're talking about changing the entire legislature from a bicameral to a unicameral legislature, which would trigger new elections. And we don't know what's going to be in this new constitution. But I think what we do know is that they're really trying to put in something for everyone. And how does that work? It seems like it's going to be difficult to implement, one. Two, it looks like they're really short on time because they have to complete this in the next couple months of trying to figure out 1,000 articles and what they're going to put in and not really have a proper debate. But two, I kind of, the analogy to me is like you have this architect who wants to build this house for everyone. They decide to put a fancy chandelier in every single room because, why not? Who doesn't want a chandelier? But the architect doesn't have to pay for that bill. It's, it's the homeowner who says, let's put a, chandelier in every single room. And then they get the bill later and they go, that actually really costs a lot. So, the fear for me for Chile is that you have all this embedded, mandated social spending, which I think is needed. I think there's an appropriate way to get there. It's gonna cost something. And, the architects of the Constitution don't have to pay for it to say. So I think watching the fiscal line, because Chile was the darling of the macro world in Latin America, and can it be going forward? I think that's going to be a big question.
Yeah, you talk about the chandelier, and I would just say I have nothing averse to having a chandelier in every room, as long as you don't have a two-story home. Because if you walk on the second floor above the chandelier, it's always going to vibrate and move. And so I have this problem.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so just be careful if you actually have a second story or an awning area. It can get really ugly.
Good to know.
So I think it's a great way to transition to the kind of the other elephant in the global room, right? And that's the relationship between Taiwan and China, right? And so we've seen a lot of headlines. There's been a lot of, exercises going out there. Now, this is going to be a jump ball for either of you of what's going on. With the emboldening Putin to go into Ukraine, does this accelerate potentially the tension between Taiwan and China? And does it embolden China to try to start to make a maneuver now, given that the world is distracted, let's say, with the invasion of Ukraine?
Potentially. So given the distraction, with what Russia's doing in Ukraine, maybe. But my view on Taiwan is that it makes more sense to push it off to a 2023, type of event. And the reason for that is at the end of this year, we're having the 20th National People's Congress in China. And Normally Chinese leaders are allowed to 5-year terms. Xi Jinping is coming up to the end of his second 5-year term, but they've removed that requirement that limit. So this will be an unprecedented third term that he's going to be appointed to. He just got through the Olympics. I know there was some disappointment from the media. They wanted the perfect Olympics, and there were some hiccups along the way. To be generous. China last year had implemented a host of new regulations that have impacted their economy from property to technology, and you're seeing slowing growth in China. So I think that China has a lot of embedded risk, as well as a very large debt stock internally that needs to be worked through. We're seeing a lot of bad debts come due. We're seeing asset management companies that step in, especially in the property sector, and they're trying to take over some of these distressed properties. So to take the risk of a geopolitical conflict now seems a little bit risky to me before Xi is able to solidify his next term, which would basically, I in my opinion, make him leader for life. That then you would kind of remove the term limits and you'd say, yeah, he's going to be there. And then add on top of that, we're probably going to be coming through a midterm election in the United States that's going to lead, that's going to have a continued divided government. We're going to have, a lot of, we're not going to have a lot of, political cohesion in the United States. And we'll be going into, thinking about a 2024 presidential election. So all of that, just like on the timing of it, seems to push the real event for Taiwan, in my mind, potentially out to next year. Now, that being said, there are a lot of similarities. China views Taiwan as theirs. The United States still recognizes Beijing as the government, even though we are giving weapons, defensive weapons, to Taiwan. In fact, just last week, or was it earlier this week, China went and sanctioned Raytheon for providing weapons to Taiwan. And we continue to see military incursions all the time. But what we're also seeing is, China is also working, some diplomatic, lines as well. They're using the build out of a new, it's an airport, might be a military airport, but on one of the closest features of Chinese mainland to Taiwan, to build out an airport, to say, we'll start taking some, extra Taipei flights here, and then we'll start to integrate the infrastructure. So maybe, there's, a non-militaristic solution that, China is trying to look to assert their control over Taiwan. Given the Taiwanese government's current stance of their posture against China, I think it's going to be a difficult one to try to do via soft power move. And what I mean by that is a couple of years ago, my thinking after watching what happened in Hong Kong is that you'd have something similar. You'd have questionable elections. You'd start to see more pro-Chinese, officials elected in Taiwan. You'd have, the combining of infrastructure, and, that would eventually lead to, fait accompli that, we're moving, the government, really, the real, decisions of government back to Beijing, as we saw happen in Hong Kong. I'm getting more and more concerned that, what we've just seen overnight, via Russia, and, how we continue to see these flights over Taiwan, incurring, where we're seeing, more, military buildup. I'm getting worried that potentially you could see, a more militaristic, solution, on the island. But again, as far as the timing, I think, and I could be wrong, because I didn't. I was surprised at how quickly Russia came into Ukraine. But again, I think the timing for this is after the 20th People's Congress. Yeah.
And you mentioned something else too about like midterms here and then the next presidential cycle, which, you know, we seem to be flipping, you know, anybody but incumbent. Seems to be kind of the trend around the world, right? Because no one seems satisfied. What happened with like the trade deal with China, right? I mean, all these, you know, phase one goals were missed. Where does this put us with the trade with China? You know, we keep talking about we're going to build back better, we're going to build America, we're going to do all these things here. Where do we sit on that front as well? And is that a burgeoning risk as well as we potentially alienate China?
Yeah, so looking at the phase one trade deal, it's you know, the U.S. The U.S. Trade Representative just put out a new report saying that, you know, actually the imbalances with Chinese trade you know, are worse now than the, you know, they were when we started the phase one trade deal.
You can always leave it to government to screw things up, right?
You know, yeah. And you can blame it on the pandemic. You can, you know, try. And there's also like a new Section 301 investigation that's coming out. You know, but ultimately, I think that this administration is not looking to ratchet up new sanctions and you know, look to, you know, upset global trade or global inflation, you know, at this point in time. I think that that, you know, from the U.S. standpoint, is influencing the trade, you know, the trade negotiations with China. But that being said, you know, when we start to look at, you know, the national securities concerns, you know, as far as export, you know, exporting, you know, materials that could be used, you know, for military purposes or dual use purposes, like we're, you know, I think all of those restrictions are going to continue. But unlike the prior administration that was willing to levy tariffs and, you know, try to, you know, address, you know, directly, you know, with, you know, direct trade tools with China, the imbalance, the trade imbalance that we currently have. This administration, I think, is, you know, trying to do that via, you know, new bills in Congress. So the view of this administration is China's a strategic competitor. You know, we're pushing forward, you know, the bill, you know, the U.S. Competes bill. There's going to be a focus, you know, hopefully it goes to where they say it's going to go, you know, to R&D, to STEM education, to, you know, trying to build out the National Sciences Institute, you know, really trying to, you know, rebuild the U.S. domestic capability, you know, for sciences and technology so that we can, you know, compete and not have to import, you know, a lot of the items that we currently are importing, you know, from China. Now, in order to do that, that's a decades-long process. That's, you know, I think that it's also...
You just don't teach science and math overnight, right? It takes time.
Yeah, and like I think there's some quick wins, though. I mean, I think if we start providing, you know, green cards and, you know, citizenship to, you know, people graduating with an advanced STEM degree and then, you know, take them around and introduce them to, you know, Silicon Valley VCs, you know, that, like, after a background check, I think that you know, picking up that type of activity makes a lot of sense. Because the one thing that we know is the U.S. needs to develop, you know, a stronger domestic growth capability. We also need to develop more goods, you know, production onshore. And, you know, I think we need to increase productivity. And, you know, I think in order to do that, you know, I think it's a, you know, it's a lofty goal, but we need to, you know, be not only providing the subsidies that other countries are providing to do that, but, you know, we probably do need to, you know, start thinking a little bit more strategically about, you know, the trading relationship of, you know, our cheap goods being dumped on into our markets, you know, really benefiting us, you know, in the long term. That being said, I don't think that we're going to see from, you know, this administration any new tariffs, you know, put in place despite, you know, what the USTR report has said.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you talk about the STEM degrees, and I look around, I'm looking around this room right now, and I'm like, wow, we got some STEM degrees that are being applied to finance,
right?
So maybe we should be out producing something instead. But that's another
topic. Good point.
That's something some people tell me all the time. If you guys could solve the problems of the world, if you didn't focus on finance, but we got to help people too. So Valerie, I want to bring it back to the Americas here. So I heard through all this, the tariffs, you know, that we started to impose, the trade with China, that there's going to be a big benefactor to the south of us, and that's Mexico.
How's that progressing? What does that look like? I mean, definitely the shipping, you know, we hear about the congestion and everything, right? We have a great workforce there. We have a great open border. How does that look?
Well, talk about governments always messing things up, right? You know, it really hasn't happened. I mean, Mexico is the obvious partner for realignment of, you know, of trade lines and supply lines. You know, obviously just from a geographical place, it's very close, has, you know, good labor, but it hasn't really happened. And part of that probably is because you had a pandemic that everybody was hyper-focused on. But I see a couple of issues going forward. One is just, you know, the leadership hasn't exactly inspired innovation and investment there. You know, I think President AMLO has done himself a disservice when he started canceling contracts. And that started when he first came into the office and canceled, you know, the Mexico City airport. And right now he's trying to push through, you know, electricity bill. And I don't think this is going to pass, but I think it's indicative of the investment climate there, where he's going to give preferential treatment to the state utility for energy generation, to the demise of, you know, private contracts, and to the demise of, you know, green energy. And the issue there is, one, obviously the you know, the ability to maintain contracts, but then also it's in, you know, probably direct violation of the newly minted USMCA agreement, both on, you know, free competition, on environmental standards, you name it. Although AMLO is out saying that there's no problem, don't worry about it. but, you know, I think there's the issue there. And I think the other issue is just the bilateral relationship between U.S. and Mexico is just, it's okay. It's not great. There's a lot of stuff going on, I think, in terms of, you know, on the migration front. I think there's a lot of, you know, work that they're doing together. I think there's issues on the security front for sure. And then there's certainly trade frictions that are happening. I mean, I don't know if you remember the guacamole gate that happened right before the Super Bowl, where we said, you know, we're not going to import any more avocados from Mexico.
And I went and picked a bunch off my tree, and I was like, this is going to be a gold mine. And by the time they ripen, the crisis is solved.
It was just a week.
How long they take. Once you pick them off the tree, they take at least a week to ripen.
You know, the millennials were really worried about their avocado toast, right, too, what was going
to
happen.
I was there to serve. You know, my trading outpost was going to be open once again.
Yeah, but, you know, the story, just the backstory behind that for anybody that doesn't know, is that the inspector was threatened by, you know, some local cartels who have control over the avocado business there. But, you know, there's obviously trade frictions in regards to how the U.S. is interpreting rules of origin for the autos industry. And then there's just, you know, constant spats, you know, between AMLO and, you know, Ted Cruz, for example, over, you know, the use of how he treats journalists in Mexico. And I just think that the simmering tensions between the U.S. and the lack of investment just really means that Mexico isn't going to fully capitalize on this realignment of supply chains to Mexico, at least in the near term. But, you know, maybe we'll have another government in 3 years or so.
Always the optimist, Val. So let's go the other direction. We've seen a lot of, you know, rhetoric up to our northern neighbors, right? With the truckers and what's happened in Canada. Is there a bigger spillover risk to what we've seen up in Canada, or has that kind of resolved itself with kind of bringing the police in and driving people out of town?
yeah, you know, trucker strikes aren't new. Trucker strikes happen, you know, all across the world, usually for reasons of, you know, protesting fuel prices, which maybe we'll see more now given where oil prices have gone, or protesting, you know, environmental rights. This was obviously a protest in terms of the vaccine mandates from going from Michigan to Ottawa over, you know, having to show proof of vaccination and, you know, general health requirements. It's the situation in Ottawa has certainly settled down. I think there was a very heavy-handed response by the government. You know, I see merit to both sides of the argument, and I don't want to get into the details there. But I think there is certainly a risk of, this protest being emulated, and we're starting to see it. We've seen it in New Zealand. Similar protests broke out there. Those were largely peaceful, but there were a lot of spats with the police, and we may see it here in D.C. on March 1st when Biden gives the State of the Union address, and we'll have to see what the response there. I think I was reading that they were considering bringing the National Guard, and it's just not a great look, I think. You know, it's obviously a really polarizing issue, and I'm not sure there's a great solution to it, but I think the risk for all these trucker strikes goes back to supply chain. So we obviously know that supply chain disruptions leads to higher inflation. Higher inflation leads to a lot of problems for governments and a lot of questions of, you know, how the central bank are going to deal with it. So I think, if we start to see more people or more countries emulating these the Freedom Convoy, I think we're going to have, one, obviously more polarization. And I think, two, I think there's a knock-on effect to inflation and the economy, of course.
Yeah, the Freedom Convoy. I mean, they got branding down at least, right?
Yes.
It's better than I call them the truckers, you know. And that's an homage to my father, who was a trucker too. So I think he's an empathizer there. So let's go to one more region of the world too, before I want to tie this all back together. And that's what's going on in the Middle East, right? So always a hotbed for geopolitical risks. But there's rumors out there that we're getting closer to an Iranian nuclear deal. So jump ball. Who wants the MEA risk?
I think, like all things today, it's coming back around to Russia-Ukraine. Earlier this week, we saw all the leaks come out. And it looked like we were very close to a deal. A lot of the issues that, there's a sense of urgency to get a deal done. We're 3 to 6 weeks, really from Iran reaching breakout capacity as far as nuclear enrichment. They're currently at 60% enrichment. You need 90% to, get to weapons grade. The estimate is like you're 3 to 6 weeks away from that. There has been some progress that, has been made on, some of the, Iranian, some of the Iranian demands that, the most specific one being the guarantee that the United States won't just take it away if you have a new administration come in. Which is, you can't guarantee that.
Yeah.
So then they came out with this idea that Parliament or Congress would need to like pass, some sort of like binding resolution. Yeah, you couldn't get that. So you had Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi come out saying that they support Biden and that, Biden is also supportive of this deal. And apparently, this is, appeased some of those concerns. There's also a discussion about the release of, some Iranian National Guards that are, on the terrorism list, to take them off the terrorism list. There's questions of, where is this nuclear material that's already been, enriched going to be stored? So you have centrifuges and you have nuclear material. And one thing that Iran wants, like as part of their guarantee, and which, maybe is why they got a little bit more comfortable, but I don't know if we should be comfortable with it, is that they want to store everything on site, in Iran. They'll just mothball it, right? So then if a new administration comes in and backs off, they just take the sheet cover off of the centrifuge and start back up.
Dust off the moss and move on.
It does,
right?
Exactly right. There are those concerns, and then also the concern that the sunset provisions, which are starting from 2026 to 2031, or the original sunset provisions, we're not pushing that out any farther. So there still is a breakout time window for a deal. All that being said, I think that, at least getting a deal done to, delay this 3 to 6 week, breakout of Iran, on the nuclear capability side, would potentially be a good thing. Some benefits are that it would bring a million barrels of oil a day back to the markets, which, would be certainly helpful.
We could use that right now, right?
Yeah, especially, now oil came, at least Brent crude was above 100 this morning, below 100 this afternoon. Who knows where it'll be tomorrow. Some of these supply concerns that are, starting to pick up around Russia, Ukraine, might be a little bit alleviated, by that. But, the big question is, outside of getting this economic benefit, You know, what are some of the other, you know, benefits that, you know, we're really going to get? Because Israel, you know, remains highly concerned. They don't support this deal for all of the obvious reasons, which, you know, I just kind of pointed to. And, you know, the question is, they're absolutely going to engage in cyber attacks, they're going to engage in sabotage, and, you know, who knows, they may engage in, you know, some sort of, you know, a military strike, you know, if they feel that there, you know, is, you know, that there is enrichment happening outside of the inspections. Also, you know, there's a real question as to, you know, what the inspectors, the IAEA inspectors, are allowed to inspect. There are current inspections that started with the old deal that Iran just wants closed out. Like, you know, stop looking at that facility. So
nothing to see here. Move on.
Right. So, you know, there are these questions. I'm surprised that we're getting very close, you know, that the deal is this close, but, you know, it very well might be. The other, you know, potential benefit, which, you know, internally we've, you know, in our group we've discussed and have questions about, are, you know, if it will reduce this, you know, Iranian proxy activity, you know, whether it's by the Houthi rebels in Yemen shooting missiles into Saudi Arabia, into Saudi Arabian infrastructure. You know, they also attacked UAE infrastructure. There's concerns about, you know, Hezbollah continuing to, you know, strike Israel. And the idea that these are, you know, true proxies of Iran and listen to Iran, you know, it is in question. So we have continued to see, you know, this activity in recent, you know, weeks, despite the fact that this deal is coming, you know, to potentially, you know, a resolution very soon. When you think that, you know, Iran would say, okay, let's back off that activity right now. So, you know, there, if you don't get, if a deal is done and then you continue to have these, you know, strikes happen, that could potentially lead to, you know, more unrest in the region. And, you know, there already are, you know, besides, you know, all of the, you know, religious and, you know, social tensions that are happening, you know, between different countries, you know, in the region, this is just likely, you know, to exacerbate it if it, you know, if it ratchets up, even in the wake of a deal. So, you know, those are, you know, just another couple of items that, you know, everyone says, oh, when the deal gets inked, a million barrels come on, that's going to be positive, oil's going to come down, everything will be great. Well, what happens if, you know, then you start to, you know, get some more of, you know, this proxy activity picking up where, you know, now another Saudi pipeline's been, or, you know, another Saudi storage facility's been hit. And, you know, that starts to cause more problems in the energy markets and the region as well. It might not be the panacea solution that people are initially thinking it would be. And then finally, it's, you know, the Ukraine-Russia crisis right now basically has, you know, brought Russia and the United States, who are at the deal table. They have other issues right now that they're obviously dealing with. So, you know, that, again, it's just another geopolitical hotspot, you know, that it could kind of go either way, but I think there's sequencing we need to pay attention to. Maybe a near-term benefit, but longer-term, there might be some more questions.
Okay, so, you know, to wrap this up too, we titled this geopolitical risk. You know, we don't eat risk, right? We eat return, right? That's what clients want. Val, give me the geopolitical reward out there of all the analysis you're doing out there. What do you think is something that investors should really focus on as having a potential reward opportunity?
I kind of touched on it a little bit before. I think that, you know, it's
I was so scared from what Bill had told me at the beginning, I couldn't pay attention to it.
It's, yeah. You know, I think geopolitical risk is hard to trade, infamously. I mean, you see these spikes, it's, you know, giantly volatile, and then just like today, things come all the way back. What I do think may be a little bit more persistent is these higher commodity prices. So what I like right now are some of the countries that are a little bit more insulated from the broad geopolitical risk, so maybe staying a little bit out of Europe, and focused on countries that will benefit from higher oil prices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. And Bill, same question to you, different answer though.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, with all of these geopolitical risks comes opportunity. And, you know, again, like Val said, we're looking at, well, we're on the same team. So, you know, we're looking in, you know, the Latin America region, you know, for plays where, you know, central banks have gotten ahead of the curve on inflation. You can also potentially benefit, you know, from China's stimulus, which is, you know, likely to happen. I would be careful, you know, about going into Chinese assets directly if, you know, they do something in Taiwan and we have similar sanctions put on, you know, Chinese assets. So you want to be playing the proxy plays. So not only countries that are linked to commodities, but countries that are linked to, you know, a potential pickup in the China growth cycle, you know, as well, is where, you know, are kind of the two areas of focus where we're looking to, you know, take advantage of, you know, some of the cheapening that's happened due to Russia-Ukraine.
I like it. I like it. So thanks for giving us some actionable ideas for our investors out there. So, all right. Now, before we let you go, this has been a very enlightening conversation. Before we let you go, I've got to do Sam Lau's favorite part of the show. So even though Sam stood me up today and refused to participate, we are still going to do his favorite part of the show, and that is called Sherman Says. I will read you the rules like Mr. Lau does to all of our guests here, even though he's out with Mr. Mayberry today. And the rules are as such. I will give you a phrase or a prompt, as he calls it. It could be a word. It could be a phrase. And we want that to elicit a top-of-mind response. Hmm. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with you, Bill.
Uh-oh.
Okay? And I'm not going to participate today because, again, Sam stood me up. So the first word to you, Bill, is NATO.
It's potentially reorganizing.
Okay. Valerie, pivot to Asia. It's in quotation marks.
Pivot to Asia. We'll see who falls in line there.
I like it. Bill, Nord Stream 2.
On ice.
Valerie, FX reserves, foreign exchange.
Nice to have.
As we all find out in crises. Good answer. Bill, efficacy of economic sanctions.
Questionable.
Okay. Val, post-Merkel Germany.
Hmm. Weaker.
Okay. Hmm. She was a good leader. Bill, yeah. Global in quotation marks. Okay. Central bank policy normalization.
Still on. It's still a freight train.
Freight train to a tighter policy.
Freight train to tighter policy.
Okay.
It looks
okay.
Like.
Yeah. Just want to clarify. Valerie, globalization.
On the reverse.
Nationalization.
That'd been better.
Okay. Okay. Bill.
Yeah.
Allies.
Changing.
Good. Okay. Valerie. Adversaries.
Oh.
It's not so easy, is it?
No, I don't know what to say about that one. I like everyone.
I know you. That's why you drew adversary, got allies.
I'm gonna pass on that one because I don't like adversaries.
You're adverse to the word adversary.
I am.
Okay, fair enough. All right, and the final question to you, Bill: Korea.
North or South? I think. Watch out.
Okay. And we won't ask which one. The last one for you, Val, Bitcoin volcano bond.
Coolest dictator ever.
Love it. All right. So that concludes our Sherman Show for today. Maybe we can coerce Sam Lau to come back to us. We're going to start a campaign on the Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. If you'd like to see Sam back, let's put some love out there for him and have him come back to us. Also, you can send us an email at the email address. It's shermanshow@doubleline.com. And again, we're looking for some positive feedback for Sam to get him back here and pull him away from the throes of Mr. Mayberry. Take care, all, and we'll speak soon.
The audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media at doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.